You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Thank you very much. Hi, good evening, everyone. It's very good to be here. Thank you very much for coming. I know it's been raining all day, and you're probably wet and tired and ready to warm up and tuck into a nice meal. So I hope I can make this worth your while. Usually when I come and speak, there's a person to talk to. And I usually will give a sort of straightforward presentation about my book. But yesterday when I sat down and thought about being here with you today, I started just writing something. And as someone who often feels writer's block, this was great. And I was just following the words and seeing what kind of paths they took me on. And so what I want to do for the first 25 minutes of this session is just to read out what I wrote yesterday.
And it feels appropriate to approach this session
maybe in a less intellectual, cerebral way, and to bring in perhaps a more poetic or tender language.
When I first came to England, this was about 18 years ago now, it was a summer evening not unlike tonight. I came into the bus station in Bristol, checked into the youth hostel, left my bags behind, and then walked around the city. I had no idea where I was at the time. I just remember walking up a long, curving hill. At the top of the hill was a set of fields, a place I later learned was called the Downs, and it was late in the day, maybe 7 o'clock or so. And I thought to myself, I'll stay here until it's dark, and then I'll walk back. But the thing is, it never got dark. The light of the summer evening just kept going, as though the light had been suspended in the hills, or somehow caught up in the trees, or as though the sun had gotten stuck somewhere, mechanically stuck, no longer in view and yet near enough to light everything up. In any case, that summer light just kept going, becoming richer and deeper and bluer, and it was still going strong well after 9 p.m. I can't recall everything I felt that day. Did I laugh? Did I walk around in a daze? Certainly, I remember being astonished. Astonished that the light could last so long. In the countries where I grew up, Indonesia and Australia, the light disappears very soon after the sun sets. On a summer night in Brisbane, it gets dark around 7:30. And in Jakarta, it gets dark even earlier, around 6:45. But because of how far north England is in relation to the equator, the light behaves differently here. It lengthens and lingers, softens and deepens, and seems to suffuse the world in a different way, burnishing everything with a milky blue film of light. Seriously, it's an amazing thing, and lucky you if you grew up in Britain with this light. And lucky us for speaking to each other in this particular light right now. I'm telling you all this because the subject of my talk tonight is lateness. And I don't just mean the lateness of a summer evening, although that too is a part of it. No, I mean another kind of lateness, which is more of a condition or a feeling that I think many of us experience today. It's the feeling you have when, after months and months of heat waves, you turn on the radio and hear that a drought has officially been declared in more than two-thirds of England. And it's the feeling you get when you talk to one of your neighbors. I grew up in the city, she tells you, and when I was a girl, the swifts would make such a racket in the sky, and hearing them was like a confirmation that the seasons were still working and things were right in the world, but I haven't seen any this summer, have you? And it's the feeling you have when you hear a politician say, not for the first time, drill, baby, drill, or when you learn that your local council is so stripped of cash that the only way they can fund urgent social care is to sell off another public property. It's that kind of lateness. In other words, it's the feeling of crisis, or rather of multiple crises coming together at once. A political crisis, a social crisis, the environmental crisis, and what might be called the crisis, a crisis of the imagination. And it's also the sense of powerlessness that comes from realizing how difficult the problems are and how deeply entrenched and apparently intractable they are. What a muddle we're all in, we might say, or perhaps even, I feel despair. There's nothing I can do. And so, yes, it sometimes feels very late out here, doesn't it? And just look at how the shadows are slowly coming to our tent, how quickly the light will soon be fading. But there's a moment, isn't there? A moment just before the night settles when things seem to shine out with a special kind of force, a special energy and presence, the glow that happens in the gloaming, the twinkle in the twilight. In these moments before the dark, it's as though we glimpse the presence of things, finally able to see, with a sudden vividness, how finely particular and well-wrought and beautifully itself each thing is. Like the way an oak tree stands up in the light, each branch curved with years of listening and growing. In these moments, I sometimes think that we're able to see things, and also each other, with a new clarity. And not just the mournful clarity that comes with twilight, that melancholy hour of contemplation and thinking, but also with the joyful clarity that comes with really seeing the world. Yes, we might say, it's getting late out there, but there's still light. And if there's still light, then it's always too soon to go home or to give up looking. And though we've lost a good portion of the day, that doesn't have to matter for now, because there ought to be just as much joy and pleasure today as there ever was before. Just as much pleasure, tenderness, kindness, and laughter. Of course, it can be hard to feel this given present conditions, and that's fair enough. Sometimes, looking at those in positions of power, we can feel a gut punch of hopelessness and dismay when we realize not only how shoddy their morals are, but how superficial their understanding of the issue is. Are these guys, and they are mostly guys, the best we can do? A few years ago, I remember Rex Tillerson, you might remember that name, saying, because climate change is an engineering problem, it will also have an engineering solution. And I remember thinking of that line from Bob Dylan, the song where he says, well, something is happening here, but you don't know what it is, do you, Mr. Jones? Of course, we need politicians and engineers. We can't do without them, but we really don't need those kinds of politicians and engineers. Because if you look at the climate crisis and only see an engineering problem, then you've completely misunderstood, perhaps deliberately misunderstood, how much the current crisis is a crisis of culture, that is, of human values and priorities. And you won't be surprised to learn, many of you already probably know, that before he served in the first Trump administration, Rex Tillerson was the former CEO of ExxonMobil. But around the same time as I read that quote, I also remember seeing a photograph of a huge banner. The banner had been unfurled from a bridge in London during an environmental protest. And the banner simply said this, "We're f***ed." And I remember thinking, well, that's better, isn't it, than burying our heads in the sand. And it's much better than the techno-optimists with their so-called solutions. But that won't do either. Because what kind of a message is that? And where does that leave you, especially if you're a teenager or a kid trying to make sense of it all? We're f***ed. No. Isn't there another place where we can gather? A place where we can resist the temptations and seductions of despair while also refusing the so-called solutions of the engineers? And if so, how might we inhabit that landscape more fully and more authentically? And what would that be like to do that work, not only with ourselves and that deep dialogue all of us engage with ourselves, but also in community with others? In one of his letters, Written in 1819, the poet John Keats refers to the world as a veil of soul making. I often think about that phrase, a veil of soul making. He's playing, of course, with the biblical idea of the world as a veil of tears. This is the idea that our lives are characterized by hardship and suffering, and that we're only freed from the trials of life once we've reached the afterlife, which is where the virtuous soul, and forgive me for the crude simplifications of this summary, but that's where the virtuous soul reaps its rewards. But by turning things around, by seeing the world as a veil of soul-making rather than a veil of tears, Keats does something different. And in particular, he helps us see experience as a kind of workshop, or even a blacksmith shop, a place where ourselves are hammered into a better and more viable shape by the difficulties of the world. And he says it's this process, the schooling of our minds through hardship, that helps us come into a deeper relationship with ourselves. I think that Keats can help us with where we are today, especially in relation to the ecological crisis. Because if we see the world as a kind of blacksmith shop, then perhaps we can also see grief and loss and pain as base metals. Metals that all of us are becoming more and more familiar with, but which, through the skillful work of our hands and hearts, can be transformed into something rare and powerful. And I know I'm stretching the metaphor here, but what if this is how a soul gets made, and how we respond to the anvil of hard and dark times, and to the hammer blows of experience? Earlier this year, an elderly activist said something to me that I don't think I'll forget for many, many years, and which I'm still trying to process now. And what she said was this: I don't believe these are the end times. I think the notion of the end times is a Hollywood thing, because really the world just keeps going, although maybe not in the way we are accustomed to. But if I did believe in the end times, what I would say is this: I'd want my community to face it in the most beautiful way imaginable. Maybe that's worth reading again. Even if I did believe in the end times, what I would say is this: I'd want my community to face it in the most beautiful way imaginable. Well, I thought that was a pretty amazing thing to say, and it reminded me of the American poet W.S. Merwin, who has a poem which contains the following line: on the last day of the world, I would want to plant a tree. I realize this is a very unconventional talk. I've been asked to speak about my book, and so far I haven't really said a word about it. I'm a terrible salesman. But when I began writing this yesterday, and when I realized that as we gathered here together, we would be meeting in the fading light of an August evening, it felt right to talk about Keats and the soul, and about hope and despair, and to think a little bit more about this question, which I've heard in various manifestations today. I've been here since around lunchtime. And the question is something like, what are we called to do in these late and difficult times? And what, in the face of so much loss and destruction and uncertainty, might a beautiful, generous, and skillful response be? What would that look like? And actually, I have a bone to pick with Mr. John Keats, because in the letter I just quoted, he says that soul-making arises from our experience of pain and trouble. And while this may be true, it's only partly true, because soul-making also emerges from joy, community, and pleasure. And there's also been a lot of that today. Grief may be a powerful base metal, but we should remember that alloys are stronger than pure metals. And sometimes the best response to the news on the radio might be to stand in front of a painting by Van Gogh, maybe one of those remarkable paintings of olive trees in the south of France, or to make a delicious bowl of soup for a friend, as well as the organizing we might be doing in our local communities, in our churches. But that bowl of soup is also really important, and that painting by Van Gogh. A few months ago, I saw a boy, he must have been about 2 or 3 years old, pointing at the sky and shouting to his father, grain grow, instead of rainbow, rainbow. And somehow that was the best thing in the world, this boy who was so excited about a rainbow that he couldn't get the words out right. And I remember a novelist on the radio talking about something that moved her deeply. A moment when, without any prompting on her part, a child rushed up to her on the street and pressed a bunch of flowers in her hands. And she said that if I can make a novel as simple and tender as that, I'd be very happy. And now I remember something from 2019 when I attended a protest organized by Extinction Rebellion. I imagine there are some of you here in this tent who were there that day. It was the moment when hundreds of people converged on Waterloo Bridge, carrying small trees and potted plants they brought from home, and how for several days after, the concrete structure of Waterloo Bridge became a floating garden, not unlike the way this tent has been turned into a kind of hanging garden. As this last example suggests, joy and the imagination can also be part of how we engage in politics, and we've heard that theme spoken about today as well. And though it might seem a little bit odd to say this, perhaps we need a bit more partying in the midst of the ecological emergency. Maybe a little bit more dancing and more good times. But what kind of a party should it be? Thinking about this question yesterday, I remembered a song by Prince, which contains a line, "Party like it's 1999." And when I looked up the lyrics, I was surprised to see how apocalyptic the song was. The first verse describes the appearance of a coming storm. Quote, "When I woke up this morning, I could have sworn it was Judgment Day. The sky was all purple. But just before we get to that famous chorus, I'm going to party like it's 1999, Prince finishes that verse with the following line. You know, I didn't even care. Well, it's a great song, but I also think we can do better than Prince. Because surely there's a way of combining joy and pleasure with care and solidarity. We can dance and sing and take care of each other at the same time. A few months ago, I heard the writer Jay Griffiths, who was here yesterday. She was speaking in Bristol a couple of months ago, and she said something I've been pondering over ever since. She said, "I cannot be well if my brother is not well. And I cannot be well if the river in my town is not well. My health depends on their health." Not the catchiest lyric, but I think a better and wiser philosophy than Prince singing, "I don't even care." I want to tell you about something I saw the other day at a supermarket near my home. An old man was standing at the till, fumbling around in his wallet, and after a while it became clear that he didn't have the money to pay for his food, and perhaps he never did. Anyway, it was a long queue and people began shuffling around. Blink and you would have missed what happened next. On her way out, a woman in a gray sweatshirt slipped 10 pounds onto the conveyor belt beside the man, and it happened with such stealth that even the cashier, who was trying to get the attention of his manager, missed it. And the woman did this so that the man did not have to acknowledge her charity in public, which might have brought him and perhaps even her some embarrassment. And of course, so that the man could eat that night. In one of his books, the writer John Berger describes these moments as pockets of resistance. And his definition of a pocket is very simple. A pocket is simply any place where two or more people come together in agreement. I love this idea of a pocket of resistance. And in fact, once you start seeing the world in these terms, you realize that pockets are everywhere. Like in the many gatherings occurring at this festival, for example, or in that painting of olive trees by Van Gogh, they're everywhere. In the part of Bristol where I live, there are some herbalists who gather some of the plants they find in fields and hedgerows. And later they turn these plants into tinctures. And then they send those tinctures to refugees and asylum seekers in the Southwest. And there are times when looking at a flower in a hedgerow, I realize that what I'm looking at is a pocket in waiting. And in those moments, the world becomes more spacious again, and things seem open-ended and possible, when just a moment ago they didn't. Yes, it's a special time, the gloaming, this lateness of the light. We might think of it as a time of endings, but if that's all we thought, we'd be wrong. because it's also a time of openings and unfoldings, as well as a moment when we can see things more clearly. More clearly because in the blueness of late summer light, things seem infinitely more precious and alive, and so infinitely more worth fighting for. I might just draw this to a close by quoting from John Berger, who I just mentioned a little bit before. I have this quote folded up in my wallet, and whenever I find things a bit difficult, I have a few other quotes in my wallet. It's not just this, but this is the one I will turn to quite a lot. And this is what he says. I write in the night, but I see not only the tyranny. If that were so, I probably would not have the courage to continue. I see people sleeping, stirring, getting up to drink water, whispering their projects or their fears, making love, praying, cooking, something while the rest of the family is asleep in Baghdad and Chicago. Yes, I see too the forever invincible Kurds, 4,000 of whom were gassed with US compliance by Saddam Hussein. I see the pastry cooks working in Tehran and the shepherds thought of as bandits sleeping beside their sheep in Sardinia. And I see a man in Berlin sitting in his pajamas with a bottle of beer reading Heidegger. And he has the hands of a proletarian. I see a small boat of refugees off the Spanish coast near Alicante. And I see a mother in Mali, her name is Aya, which means born on a Friday, swaying her baby to sleep. I see the ruins of Kabul and a man going home, and I know that, despite the pain, the ingenuity of the survivors is undiminished, an ingenuity which scavenges and collects energy. And in the ceaseless cunning of this ingenuity, there is a spiritual value, something like the Holy Ghost. I am convinced of this in the night, although I don't know why. That's what came out yesterday when I was thinking about what I could say to you. And I've felt so full and nourished by lots of the talks I've heard today, noticing calls to action, calls to more organizing, calls to more involvement, all of which I, of course, endorse and add my energy to. But I just felt with the gloaming hour upon us, I wanted my contribution to speak at that soul level, to use those words from Keats. And just thinking about the rest of the time we have each other here with each other now, I'm wondering if you could find a partner, someone next to you, or maybe someone you haven't met. And first of all, maybe just sit for a minute or two with some of the questions around grief and joy that have come up in this talk. By the way, this is all an invitation, and if you find that you can't speak to these themes for any reason, then that's completely fine. There's no expectation or no pressure. But after a moment or two of reflection, I invite you to turn to your neighbor and just say, talk about one thing that you feel real grief about when you think about the natural world. And the person next to you is just called upon to just witness that person's speaking of that experience. No consolation or no trying to fix anything, but just a witnessing of that person's, whatever that person's grief might be. And then the next question and the final question is for the other person to do that as well. And then to follow that up with this other question, which is, what brings you joy and pleasure in the natural world? So about 6 minutes for that conversation, if that's okay. And again, it's all an invitation. And then it'd be really wonderful if we could share some of those things as a group. I'll be your timekeeper. It's just on 7 now, so we'll have about six minutes for that. So a moment of reflection, and then something that brings you real grief, and just witness what the other person says about that. And then something that brings you real joy. Thank you.
Okay, I think we've, just with an eye on the time, I think it'd be really lovely now if we were able to come back as a group. And there's an invitation to maybe share, if you like, some of the things that came up in your pairs, whether that was around grief or joy. Jemima's very happy to walk around with the microphone if anyone wants to just speak into the space. And really anything is welcome. And I can already tell we have a group here who will really listen and witness in a really open-hearted way. So if anyone wants to share anything that came up, it'd be really wonderful to hear from you.
Thank you. It's been wonderful to just be here and listen to you. You've got great voice, lovely words. Thank you. When you were speaking, it really about the light issue. So this is the South. We live in Shetland, over 60 degrees north. So in the winter, we get from 9-ish to 3-ish daylight. And when I was being interviewed for the job that I've got, I was asked, would you cope with not just the weather, but the lack of light in the winter? But in our first winter, we discovered the joy of amazing light, because the sun never lifts much above the horizon. But it means you get that gloaming all day. So there may not be a lot of light, but the quality of light is phenomenal. And you see parts of the landscape in a way that, well, it just illuminates the landscape. So thank you.
Can you say, thank you for sharing that. Can you say a little bit more about how you're seeing changes in that light? What is it about the quality of that time or the blueness of the light that allows you to see things differently?
I would say the yellowness and orangeness more than blueness. And it just lifts the landscape and you see far more of the contours. The shadows are long all day. So it's just, you see the world differently. So, you know, I was interviewed and asked the question, how will you cope with the darkness? No one said, how will you cope with the light?
Yes.
Which, you know, has been a real blessing. And we haven't struggled with the darkness, though many people do. And I recognize that that is an experience that some people have. And then, of course, in the summer, we have daylight all day and night. You go to bed and it's light. You get up in the middle of the night and it's light. So it's just a different experience.
Thank you. It's great to hear that. Would anyone else like to share anything that came up for them or for their, yeah, in their partnerships? Oh, great. Thank you.
You might have to come to me. This has happened.
I mean, I know we've just already spoken about light, but I think in the summer, it's really, really beautiful how long it stays out. And just how warm it is, how warm it can get. We had an incredible summer. I mean, we live in London. It was ridiculous. There's 35 degrees for like a whole week. And what I got to do this summer was I got to spend a lot of time with my friends. On Friday nights, we would go to the park and we could play some football. And it was a really nice experience that I think I'll miss a lot in the winter, because obviously it won't stay light at 8 and 9 o'clock. But it's some of those nights where I just remember how loved and how much I love my friends and how much I love the sun and the summer.
Oh, that was so beautiful. How much I love my friends and how much I love the sun in the summer. Thank you very much for sharing that. I remember calling my mom and my dad, by the way, when I first came to England, talking about how you could play football at 9:30. That was like that was worth a whole phone call home, and you had to pay with those international calling cards. You probably don't know what that is, but it was worth making that phone call. And I think a different kind of... One thing I should have really mentioned at the beginning, and in fact, Jemima told me I should say this, but the title of my book is Late Light. And the title is trying to do two things, I guess, which is to hold together a contradictory set of experiences that I think many of us have. One is the sense of lateness, you know,
One in seven species in the UK are now endangered or threatened. We've lost 40% of eco-abundance since the 1950s. Things are really late, and I think I especially feel that if you're young and you've come onto a world that feels like it's in the twilight hour. But the light, there's still light. And in that light, things are possible. You can think in a different way. You can stretch your soul in a different way. You can make community in a different way. And you can resist what I called earlier the temptations of despair, which are so, you know, the temptations are so great. But there's a lovely quote from Rebecca Solnit who says in her book, Hope in the Dark, it's always too soon to go home. It's always too soon to go home. And my father was a baseball fan. He loved playing baseball and talking about baseball. One of his favorite players was this catcher for the New York Yankees called Yogi Berra. Do you know Yogi Berra? He was the author of many zany quotes like, baseball is 99% physical, the other half is mental. And if you come to a fork in the road, take it. Things like that. But he had this great thing he said about the original Yankee Stadium. The original Yankee Stadium, the way it was orientated in relation to the sun, meant that late in the day, sort of towards the eighth or ninth inning, because the sun was setting, it would cast shadows over the left-hand side of the field. And Yogi Berra says in his wonderful way, it gets late early out there. And he's talking about the left-hand side of the field. And when I was writing this book and I was thinking of Yogi Berra, I thought, oh, that's exactly it. It feels late early. But the game is still being played. There's another innings. And actually, who knows, there might be another innings after the ninth, after the tenth. So holding on to those two things. Sorry, I couldn't sum it up any better than what you just said about I love my friends and I love the lights. That's perfect. Any other responses or sharings? Yeah, there's in the front here.
Sorry.
I was saying that after, so used to the summer, the grass being brown, after this rain you can see the green peeking through already. And if we just allow, stop messing around, some things it's too late, but nature can repair itself, and we just have to work towards allowing it to repair itself. That was my joy, seeing the green grass peeking through.
Thank you. Green grass peeking through, the force of green growing things.
Can I share?
Yes, of course.
I am brilliant at killing plants. Like every plant that I ever get given just ends up dying. But I have friends that are really like big encouragers, and they're like, oh, don't worry, water it anyway. And just like a few plants every now and then. There were some bushes that I decided I no longer wanted, so I ripped them out. And then I decided I did want, and so planted them back in. And I was like, they're dead. They're never going to grow again. And just with a little bit of nurture, like they came back to life. And it was just beautiful and gorgeous, and I feel so much more grounded having been here and listening, just to stay in the present moment and to just look around at the world around. You've really helped me be able to just contemplate and meditate in a world of awe and wonder. So thank you.
I'm thinking of a great phrase from an American writer called Wallace Stegner, and he talks about a geography of hope. Mm-hmm. And something you've both just said has made me think of that phrase. And I'm also thinking about this really precious landscape to me that folks from Bristol, I know there's a few Bristolians here, mm-hmm. folks from Bristol might know about. It's called Trooper's Hill. It's a big character in the book. Trooper's Hill is a place where you find rare flowers that grow nowhere else in Bristol, including gorse and broom. And as I was learning a little bit more about this place during the pandemic, this was the place I would go to every day for my 1 hour outdoors. And I was just paying attention to this place that usually I had just walked through before, but I was now forced to consider it carefully and closely. And realizing, oh, there are plants here that I have not seen anywhere else in Bristol. And then I started researching the history of Troopers Hill. And then I realized the reason all these flowers are here is because Troopers Hill was an industrial site for many, many years. It was a place of quarrying. They quarried limestone there. And it was also a place where they smelted copper. And the reason those flowers were growing there was because the landscape was so knackered from industrial interventions that the pH level of the soil was stripped away. And it's precisely because the soil is so nutrient poor that you have rare wildflowers growing there. And because of the quarrying, the landscape there is unstable, which is why it's never been developed. And I was thinking about how the green of growing things can flourish in the places that have been hurt and damaged the hardest. And that, for me, is part of the geography of hope, thinking about Troopers Hill and how badly it was devastated, how poorly it was stewarded, but how, with a little bit of benign neglect, it's been able to surge into green life again. And it's also a place where grasshoppers and crickets sing in the most amazing choruses. The grasshoppers sing in the daytime, and the crickets take over at night for the night shift. And you can sit there and just immerse yourself in the sound. Sometimes I fancy I can hear the crickets or grasshoppers singing something like, we're still here, we're still here, despite everything that's gone on. Speaking of grasshoppers, one of the things I found in this book again and again was you learn something about a species. And it's a natural fact, but it actually opens up a way of thinking about social relations, or it offers a metaphor or a key for thinking about culture. And one thing I learned when I was researching crickets is that they have this incredible evolutionary adaptation where a cricket can stridulate, so it's rubbing its wing against its leg to make a very loud sound to attract other mates or to tell them to back off. To tell competitors to back off. And as it does that, it can mute the reception of its own sound. In other words, it deafens itself to the racket that it's making. And the reason it does that is because if it was able to hear its own sound, it would literally go deaf. So the cricket has this amazing capacity to listen to others by... it can sing and not hear its own singing, so it can better hear the songs of others. And I'm just raising that now because that was a moment where I thought, the cricket is showing us a really interesting way forward. What would it be like if we could be more attentive to the songs of others, even as we sing? What would it be like to be part of a chorus, singing in the dark, but receptive, more receptive to the sounds of others rather than our own music? And that was definitely a theme that was gifted in a way by the crickets. Does anyone want to share anything else that came up? Because I also have a few more things I could say about the book. Yes, there's a hand up here. Thank you.
Thank you for what you've said. This is not really related to the conversation we had, but today I've listened to lots of people talk about campaigning and being activists and about why we should be activists and about the links with our faith and all kinds of stuff like that. But what you've just done this in the last hour, well, not even an hour yet, is brought me back absolutely to why I would want to do it. And it was instant. The minute you started to talk about your observation of the light, and it reminded me how I've been taught at different times to just look at what's happening around me in great detail. And that description of the light, I've lived in the UK all my life. I've travelled occasionally to other places, but it never occurred to me that anyone could arrive in the UK and think, gosh, why is it still light? What's happened to it? And that you chose, that you observed it. and you observed it well enough that you kept a record in your mind, and then you made a record that you've brought to us today that's linked to how, it's reminded me of how important it is to notice all this world around us. And it's not just, you're not just noticing it, you're actually bringing it to the notice of everyone else. So, and this is an arts festival, and I know it's art is action as well, but what you've done is bring the art this evening, and I'm just so grateful that I actually came along and listened to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That's made the whole trip from Bristol worth it, just to hear that. Although I should say, if you went to Indonesia and Australia, you would notice things about the sunset that I would probably take for granted. You know, it's because it was so unusual for me that I sort of had to notice it. But what something you said though is, I don't know how to say this. I have a theory sometimes that we're actually in paradise. And all it takes is just like lifting the pepper grinder on your table and you see it. It's that close. And also it's that far, because that pepper grinder can be super hard to lift sometimes. But I don't know. Does anyone else have this feeling as well that we're actually in paradise?
I definitely feel it on occasion, yes.
And I just like, you know, I'm here for the... I think I really need to hear the questions around activism and how we can contribute. But I also think we should be talking about these moments of paradise, because they're part of what, you know, what we're fighting for and what we care for. I see a hand coming up in the back there.
Hi. My sadness was about the trees burning. We hear about Amazon trees burning, and somehow that's hard to visualise, but the ones in Dunwich in Suffolk was much more easy to visualise than the local wildfires. So that's the sadness, the trees, the individual trees, you know. But I live with quite a lot of oak trees, and so the joy is the spending time with the oak trees, which is amazing. And I find that they say different things at different times, but when I sort of, you know, I lean on them and see if I can imagine what they might be saying, and maybe they speak, I don't know. And I said, well, what about these fires? And they said, well, we're not worried, because we're all right now. Look, we're here. We're enjoying the sunshine. We have roots so deep. We're enjoying paradise right now. Learn from us. Yeah.
Thank you for sharing what the oak trees are saying in your part of England. You reminded me of a great line from Richard Powers' novel, The Overstory, where he says, if we could really listen to the trees, we would be drowned by meaning. I love that. There's so much abundant meaning. And if we could just listen to an inch of it, we would be drowned. And there's that lovely line from Middlemarch by George Eliot, where she says, if we could listen so intently that we could hear, I'm paraphrasing, if we could listen so intently that we could hear the squirrel's heartbeat, and the growth of the grass, we would hear the roar on the other side of silence. And actually, it's not silence at all. It's just a question of tuning in and taking the time to move, in your case, at plant speed, oak speed, because at that speed, different things become apprehensible to you.
One of the things I find with the activism here is I just feel so hopeless. I just... completely overwhelmed. I feel there's nothing I can do. And the one thing that brought me grief was actually the same thing that brought me joy, which is my heart breaks every time an animal dies. But the first thing that came to my mind when I thought of joy was the first time I saw a kingfisher, or the first time I finally saw a rusty spotted cat in the zoo. So, a bit like the trees, that lady said, they're going on being kingfishers, being cats, being pangolins that have pango pups, by the way, if anyone's interested. And they don't feel it hopeless. So maybe there is hope after all.
Thank you. I realize that's a hard thing to share, but it's really valuable to hear that. And what you've made me think with your connection between hope and grief is... I'm thinking of that. There's a lovely line from Nick Cave where he says, grief and love are inseparable. You can't have the love without having the grief. And I often will remind myself of that when I feel grief and think, this is part of love. The grief is part of love. And it's in that remembering that the grief is part of love that I feel a surge of energy, speaking for myself. But I also hear and recognize that that surge of grief that you feel can feel incapacitating. For me, the love is energizing. And the grief is a kind of, to go back to that Keats idea of the world as a blacksmith shop, that grief is the hammering. And how we respond to that is the molten of the self spreading, stretching, trying to take on more and more beauty, as it were. But it's not easy work. I'm thinking we have about 5 minutes left. Something in my mind is just coming up to the surface now. It's this this video I watched of Noam Chomsky many years ago. And he talked about a lecture he gave in Buenos Aires, and he gave the same lecture in Boston. And it was a lecture about, you know, American hegemony and power and capitalism and the things that Chomsky would talk about. And he said something really interesting. He said, after he gave the lecture in Boston, he had all these young people coming up to him saying, oh, I agree with what you say, all the problems that you sketched out. What can we do? What can I do here in Boston? And he says, when he gave that same talk in Buenos Aires, he had all these people coming up to him afterwards saying, thanks for your talk, it was really interesting. Can I tell you what I'm doing? Can I tell you what my neighbor is doing? Can I tell you what my friend is doing? And he was just overwhelmed by all these people who were in the middle of projects. This is a kind of response to what you raised earlier, but you said you felt a sense of overwhelm, and you're talking about the activism here. And I just wanted to just use this moment to make space for other forms of activism that might not look like activism. And I was talking to my friend Naomi earlier. We were talking about how just as much as we need activists on the street, we need activists of the imagination. And that is also important, hard work. It might not look like the kind of the necessary, heroic, everyday forms of organization that we do in Extinction Rebellion or in our church communities or wherever it might be. That is so necessary. But at the same time, I think there's this other soul work that can happen alongside the boring admin meeting, by the way. You can do both at the same time. But not everyone is called upon to do the hard activist work. And I think we need to make space for those gifts and talents those people have. But that's the phrase that has really resonated with me, that we need activists of the imagination just as much, or in a way maybe even more than activists on the street, because we need to change the deep blueprints that is forcing us not to listen to the oak tree or not to pay attention to the kingfisher. How do we do that work for ourselves, but also in community with others? I think that's a big question. That aren't we lucky enough to have that question? What a beautiful question to think about, actually. How do we do that work beautifully and to listen in that way? I'm more and more inspired by some of the questions that we're confronted by. Yes, a lot of despair, a lot of grief, but I don't know, I feel inspired by some of the questions and by the beautiful way I see people responding to them. It's late, my friends. It's 7:30. I think we need to be wrapping up soon. Is that right, Jonathan, for the next speaker? Just want to say, yeah, can we just maybe look at each other in the tents and just acknowledge some of the big things we're carrying? And I just want to say thank you for your presence and your attention. And it's dry outside. There are some good consolations. Take care of yourselves. Go really well. I'd love to speak to anyone who wants to linger and hang out. Thanks again.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts. for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.